Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American teens and college kids today are the country's first generation born with no off switch. They're online all the time and almost never out of touch. Texting, friending, posting, tagging, gaming, flirting, tweeting. It's a full-time job being a plugged-in teen, a lifestyle. A big news study by the MacArthur Foundation says it's okay that in the flurry of instant messages and video chats, American teens are building a deeply networked culture and actually learning a thing or two. This hour on Point, American Teens and the Internet, we'll hear from the study and from the teens. You can join the conversation. Do you see the new youth culture unfolding on the Internet? Are you part of it? What do you make of its intense social fabric? Joining me from Culver City, California today is Mizuko Ito, Mimi Ito. She's a research scientist at the Department of Informatics at the University of California, Irvine. She recently led a massive three-year study about teens and the Internet, sponsored by the McCarthy Foundation. Mimi Ito, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from Culver City is Ana Huerta, a student at the University of Southern California, where she's studying interactive media and no doubt using it all the time as well. Ana, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with me here in the studio is Abella Anidi. He's a freshman at Harvard, an intern for us here at On Point last spring. Abella, it's great to have you back. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Mimi Ito, take us into your study first. Hours, thousands and thousands of hours watching teens use the Internet. And what did you find?
Well, the goal of our study was really to take some time and talk to kids and, you know, look at what they were doing online. And what we found was that, you know, there were a lot of things that were motivating learning online that were often different from what kids were getting in school. And that is part of the sort of social and recreational activity that kids were engaged in. They were picking up a whole host of new technical, social, and media literacy skills.
Those social skills are what jump out here because this is just a new medium for socializing. Like none we've ever had before, human instincts are social, but the proliferation of ways to interact here is just gigantic. Give us a sense of the depth, the sort of density of that social network that's emerging on the Internet, Mimi.
I think, like you say, the content of what kids and adults, too, are doing online as far as hanging out socially is not so different from what an earlier generation did, spending time with friends, worrying about how you look and how you are located and with social networks. I mean, this is the kind of thing that parents also grew up with. I think what's different is that the media and technical environment in which this is happening is incredibly networked and complex and changing very rapidly. So, for example, you know, even just really common everyday behaviors like hanging out and flirting, you know, you're having to navigate accessing media, looking for information online, building a personal web page, all kinds of new technical skills that weren't part of the social landscape even a decade ago.
Abella, you're with me here in the studio in Boston. I intersect with this teen world a fair bit, and I have to say, even to me, someone who uses the Internet all the time, I'm really struck by how tight the fabric is online. I mean, teenagers just plugged in all day, texting wherever they are on their cell phone, and when they've got their laptop, video chatting, posting on their Facebook walls, constantly. I am constantly back and forth. It seems like, in a way, it never stops. There's kind of a bubble of interaction around kids all the time.
Well, I think thanks to the technology that we have today, it really boils down to a matter of convenience. With texting and using social networks such as Facebook and MySpace, a lot of teenagers, both in high school and in college, are just really trying to find a way to stay in touch with one another at their easiest convenience, especially when you have friends in college who are across the country in California and Washington. It's so much easier to start a thread on Facebook, emails, a thread of emails where you can just stay connected and hear stories without ever having to pick up the phone or waste any money or send letters.
Right, right. So, how antique can you get the idea of letters? Exactly. Ana Huerta, in California, I mean, I have to say, having grown up before the internet, you know, I recall long stretches of solitude. Not just did I not know what other kids were doing. Of course, you could use the phone, but not all the time. But, you know, but just being alone, not plugged into anything. In your life today, Ana, and the life of your friends, give us a sense of how that interaction occurs, how often, how dense the fabric of interaction is.
Well, I probably text pretty much from when I get up until I go to sleep. I probably went to bed about 1, and it was because I was texting instead of sleeping.
Texting meaning little bursts of messages to friends all over the place, just like what's up or what sort of thing?
Yeah, just talking about her day, saying jokes through texting. I have a friend that we're just constantly texting pretty much from when we get up to when we go to bed, and then there's maybe about 6 other conversations going on. And so a lot of that time that leaks in to go into MySpace, and we just type messages to each other or go on Facebook and type more messages and send pictures, send videos. It's not just talking. It's showing something that we found on the internet, and we want to share it with someone else.
Facebook, there is a universe, a cosmos in itself where kids are sort of living all the time, even as they're walking through the physical world. I mean, you go to somebody's Facebook page, and you've got very often huge albums of photographs of their life, very often entirely up to date. I mean, you can get a big read on someone very quickly, Abella, just by tapping their Facebook page for a minute.
Your Facebook homepage and your profile, basically, some people use that to fully express themselves. You have your interests, your favorite movies, your favorite quotes, your favorite books, where you go to school, and then not only that, but your wall, also located on your profile, has all of your friends and their messages and what they've been writing to you. So your other friends can see who you've been talking to, what's been going on in your life, just by viewing your homepage. And like you said, the profile also is the home of your pictures and all of your other sources that you have that of expressing yourself, really, to not only your friends but people who may not even know you that well.
Ana, how long does it take you to get a beat on someone's personality, their life, their sort of their attitude from their Facebook page? How revealing is it?
Sometimes it's too revealing. Other times it's not revealing at all. I think it depends on the person's how they've set up their Facebook. But I've really got to see what a lot of my friends are interested in that wouldn't have come up in conversation. So sometimes it does explore into the personality, and sometimes it's completely off from what I would have thought.
Mimi Ito, you've done this huge study. You've got many angles that you pursue here. Part of it is the socializing. Part of it is when kids get really interested in a particular subject and go deep on it online. But it's interesting how the press coverage of your study has all picked up on this kind of reassuring bottom line people have drawn out of it for parents, saying, hey, this, don't worry about all that time your kids may be online. This is not necessarily a bad thing. Has the press got it right in grabbing that headline, Mimi?
I think that a big goal of our work was really to try to describe what's happening from the kids' point of view. So I think a lot of the public discussion about this has focused on risks and scary stuff and downsides of youth use of online technology. So we were definitely trying to say, well, you know, this is what adults are worrying about, but what are kids actually getting out of it? So in that sense, I think the coverage was right. I mean, I do think that there's another dimension to this, which is that it's not just that, you know, kids are right and that you shouldn't worry, but there's also a lot that adults can do to engage with this stuff. And, you know, that's a piece that I would like people to consider as well. Like you said, not all kids are taking full advantage of the learning opportunities on the internet. I think there's a lot of potential out there for kids really to pursue interests and dive deep on things that they're really passionate about, but it's really only a minority of kids who are doing that right now.
You divide internet activity among American teens, American youth, into two great big categories. One, friendship, the social side, the other, what you call geeking out. What do you mean?
Right. So we try to use words that kids would recognize. You know, our book is going to be called Hanging Out, Messing Around, and Geeking Out. And by geeking out, we really mean, you know, those activities where kids are sort of engaged in self-directed learning around topics that they're really interested in, and getting involved in these online groups that share specialized knowledge around, you know, sometimes technical, sometimes creative kinds of areas. You know, it could be making YouTube videos, it could be modifying games, it could be, you know, engaging in a fandom around a Harry Potter or anime or something like that. And what happens is that kids can find other people, adults and kids, who share those passionate interests. And it's that moment that we call geeking out.
I'm sure there are downsides here, but I think back on all the scholarship and writing about modern American life and how big alienation and loneliness, the lonely crowd, that whole idea, how big that's been, Mimi. And here you have a generation, there may be downsides, there must be, and we'll talk about them. On the other hand, these are kids who are socially networked, socially tied in a way that, you know, I was joking in the introduction about the Mayflower, but it seems to me to go all the way back to when people lived and worked cheek by jowl, almost in, you know, rural communities or dense urban communities that we now look back on with nostalgia. Maybe that intimacy is being reborn through this technology.
I think what's really interesting, as you say right now, and, you know, this current moment, is that it's not that social alienation is going to go away, but I think what's different is that media and network technologies have become so central to social life. So I think even a decade ago, you know, things like playing video games or being in front of a screen was really more associated with social isolation. But right now, if you look at what kids are doing, whether it's gaming or, you know, engaging in television or engaging in online communication, it's happening in this incredibly rich social environment. And that's what's very interesting, is that intersection between the social side and the media side.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American teens and the internet and the new American youth culture unfolding on the web. Mizuko Ito, Mimi Ito, is with us from the University of California, Irvine. She helped lead a huge new study sponsored by the McCarthy Foundation, spent hours and hours observing how teens use the internet. They found a lot of social interaction there, and also some teens going very, very deep on areas of interest. I'm joined in the studio by Abella Aniti, one-time intern with On Point, and now back as guest today. He's a freshman at Harvard University. Ana Huerta is with us from the University of Southern California. She's a junior there, studies interactive media. In just a moment, we're going to go even younger than my guests here, but let me get a call first from Peter in Somerville, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you know, Peter?
Well, I've got two kids, 7 and 9, and the 9-year-old boy has a friend who moved to Italy in September with his family for a family adventure in Italy.
Okay.
And they communicate via Skype, and it's like a daily thing. And even with a 6-hour difference, they time it so that when my son gets home from school at 3 o'clock, he's talking to his friend Jason at 9 o'clock at night. And
Skype, so internet, telephone, and you're not freaking out because it's not breaking the family budget. It's online.
Exactly. And it's just... It's like the internet on steroids now, because, you know, they're meeting kids from abroad at a very young age. They're learning, you know, about different cultures, how good the kids are playing soccer over there.
And you're talking about 7 and 9-year-olds. I mean, imagine a century ago, they, you know, their friends would have sailed off and never been seen again. Even a decade ago, if they moved to Italy, they would blink out. They'd be gone. Now they're still part of their lives.
Isn't it wild?
It is pretty.
Yeah, we're very excited. And even from a business aspect, you know, I'm a landlord in town, and I've got apartments that I've wired specifically for the younger kids getting out of school, and they just love it. They don't have to mess around with the accounts. They just move in, they plug in, and they're ready to go.
Peter, do you think your kids are going to grow up with a different sense of the world, of their social lives, of themselves, because of this technology?
Hopefully. I think so. I think it's going to be great. I think they're going to have a world perspective that we only dreamed about as adults, that they're going to have engaged in at a very young age and not think twice about it.
Peter, thank you very much for calling. Mimi, there's 7 and 9-year-olds via the internet not losing touch with friends who move halfway around the world. And that's just an extreme example of what Abella's talking about, keeping friendships when you move from high school to college with friends who are all over the country that might have been gone before. Did you get a sense from your study, Mimi, of the size of the social network that a normal online kid would have today compared to, I don't know, decades ago?
I think what's interesting is that there is a huge amount of variation in the kinds of networks that kids engage in. And on the friendship-driven side, we find that, you know, mostly kids are reproducing the same kind of social networks they have in school or church or, you know, other activities they're in. But what's interesting about it is that, you know, like your caller said, you know, kids can stay in touch with friends that, you know, they may have lost touch with in an earlier generation because they're not as constrained by locality. So, you know, that network just continues to broaden. I think the other thing is that, you know, on the interest-based side, when kids want to reach out to people because they share a particular area of interest, then you see the network really expanding beyond the local friendship group. And that, you know, those communities can be huge.
Let's bring another voice into this conversation. The youngest voice at our table, Sarah Polin, joins us from Redondo Beach, California. She's a freshman at Redondo Union High School in Redondo Beach. She's 14 years old. Sarah Polin, we're so glad that you've joined us today. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Wow, you've got a grown-up voice. You sound like you could be way out in the world for a 14-year-old. That's terrific. Sarah, are you online every day?
Almost always, usually to check in on Facebook or just see how my friends are doing or if they've posted anything for me to look at.
When in the evening, when you get home from school, is it a PC or a laptop? What do you work with, Sarah?
I work with a MacBook Pro laptop most of the time.
And do you sort of carry it with you wherever you are in the house when you're doing your homework or, I don't know, moving from room to room?
Yeah, I try and have it with me almost at all times just to catch up with people.
And if I know how this works, and I've seen some of this, you've kind of got an eye on it, I'm guessing, most of the time as you do your homework, maybe as you watch television, even as you talk with your parents, that internet space is present. I mean, you're still keeping an eye on your internet life, are you not?
Yes, that is true. I do keep an eye on it almost no matter what I'm doing.
So, do you have a Facebook page?
Yes, I do.
Do you post photos from your life there, like what you did over the weekend or a trip you took or friends?
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
So if I go to your Facebook page, how, you know, and spent 5 or 10 minutes there, how deep a picture of you would I get? How quickly?
It really depends on the information that I have up there. But it depends. Yeah, you could get a pretty deep picture based on my Facebook or other sites that I have about the things that I do and things that I enjoy doing.
And what about when you meet new kids? Do you check out their Facebook pages? Do you sort of size up who they are, what they're about? Is that how you use it as well?
Yeah, if I meet someone new, I might go on their Facebook page and compare friends, see, oh, they know this person, or, oh, they know that person, and, you know, go from there.
And how would you feel if your internet access was cut off for a day or a week or a month?
Well, for a day, I might not mind. I might not miss that much. But for a week, it would be pretty dramatic because a lot of the interaction with my friends and most of the people that I hang out with comes from online and updates and chats that we have. So I would miss out on a lot.
Sarah, you're awesome. Abella, I mean, this sort of awareness factor of the internet. Facebook in particular does this because people show so much of themselves and their lives there. But the sort of sizing people up and communicating with new people, also a huge angle of this interaction.
Yeah, like Sarah said, if you, for instance, receive a friend request from someone that you may not know, Facebook often allows you to check that person's profile in order to see, you know, whether you guys have common friends or common interests or where the connection lies or how they found out about you in order to friend you in the first place. So the fact, the meeting of new people and the starting of a new friendship on Facebook happens almost all the time.
And beyond their other friends, what else do you look for as kind of signifiers of whether or not this person might be someone you'd want to roll with?
A lot of the time you can check what network they're assigned to, you know, whether they're assigned to a particular university. For instance, I'm assigned to the Boston, Massachusetts, and
so
also the Harvard network.
Institutional and geographic, but you must also get a sense of what kind of person is this from what they put up there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I said, there are sections about their personalities, you know, their books, what sports they did, what their interests are. And then you can look at their wall to see what people have been posting on their wall and who they've been communicating with. It's all just a way, and even their photographs, it's all just a way of really trying to find a connection between you and this new person who wants to be your friend on Facebook.
Ana Huerta, in Culver City, do you trust what you see at Facebook? Are people putting up a facade, or is there enough that's genuine there that you can really get a reading on someone who you may never have met from this social interaction online?
As far as Facebook goes, I think it's the things that gets asked of people to put on there. It's basically like, what's your favorite book? What are you interested in? As opposed to like MySpace, where it's more you write about yourself and write all these things that are more of a facade. So with Facebook, I feel it's a lot more straightforward of what people are actually interested in doing rather than them faking what they like.
And Abella, a lot of kind of dating and checking out activity has moved online.
A lot of,
I mean, there's online dates, internet dates where you may not have
met the person initially, yeah.
Even met the person yet, but you're kind of just sniffing around, checking it out.
Honestly, I don't know how much of online dating occurs on Facebook or MySpace, but I think it more goes to the fact that people are communicating and meeting new people that they may be interested in through Facebook, people that they actually haven't even met in person, and then taking a step forward to actually pursue them offline and on campus. So it's interesting, that dynamic, that you meet someone online, never really met them in real life, and then you think based on their interests, their photos, their wall posts, that you may be interested in actually like pursuing a date or two with this person, and then you follow that up with meeting them offline. It's interesting.
It all goes on right there. Let's take a call from Bennington, Vermont, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Mike?
I'm actually 30 years old. I'm a college professor. I teach freshmen, so I kind of feel like I'm on the front lines of observing this kind of change within communication. And I think that the kind of studies that you mentioned before kind of give a false solution, saying, you know, oh, this kind of communication is good or it is not bad. I don't think it's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. Because when these kids are communicating this way, it may be like in a village mentality, like you were mentioning before, mm-hmm. like the pilgrims, you know, everyone is close, everyone is very connected with each other. But I feel that now communication has changed because there is less time for reflection between communications. Like if someone says something to you and it might anger you, you instantly write something on their, you know, Facebook site or instant message them or something, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, maybe walking down the street of the village to communicate with that person. I think that the kind of communication has changed, not necessarily the fact that they are communicating.
That is fascinating in itself, Mike. Maybe no time for a walk around the lake or a walk in the woods here. It's right back in the communication. But you're acknowledging that change that this generation's part of, and it's really fascinating. Let me get another call on this front from Weston, Massachusetts. Tia, you're on the air. Mike, thanks for calling. Hi, Tia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm 32 years old, and my husband and I are sort of, you know, self-proclaimed Facebook addicts, and, okay. and we both feel there are more benefits to all this social networking than there are downfalls. My concern, I guess, is, you know, as a former high school and middle school teacher, my concern really is that kids today may not really understand what friendship means almost. I mean, I know they're still seeing their friends in school, et cetera, but when you have 500, quote, friends on Facebook, I feel like it emphasizes quantity over quality. I also think somehow knowing what someone is doing that night or what their status update is online, somehow it just feels very superficial that in some ways kids may think, oh, I can now dig deeper and find out more about this person if I'm interested, but somehow that curiosity seems to be satisfied by the very, you know, superficial or just on the surface information these networking sites allow. And that's, I guess, where my concern is, that when you have, you know, kids who are 12, 13, 14 years old who are very much on these sites and spend a lot of time on these sites.
Tia, let me pick it up with our guests, and thank you very much for raising that angle as well. Ana Huerta in Culver City, let me bring it to you. We've got two callers, both kind of saying, yes, there's a lot of interaction, but is it maybe, isn't it superficial? Isn't it just kind of the surface? Do kids even know what friendship means when you've got 500 quote-unquote friends at your Facebook page? What do you say to that, Anna?
I think the younger generation can distinguish who's really their close friends and then who's kind of like an acquaintance. And now acquaintances are becoming these online acquaintances where you get a lot more than just passing them by and saying hello on the street. But your closer friends you're most likely to hang out with in real life. You know, maybe you wouldn't hang out with all 500 people. So,
and Abella, what about the instant response that our caller Mike in Bennington, Vermont asks about? I mean, when you're sort of shooting, you know, messages back and forth or posts back and forth, does it bleed away a certain depth or is there no cause and effect necessarily there?
I think it depends on what you're using to communicate. I think the caller brought up the fact of AIM, instant messaging, mm-hmm. and I think the name of the program speaks for itself
right,
because
right.
Exactly. Ping, ping. And I think I totally agree that there are times in which you're communicating with someone else and you may type out something and send it that you probably wouldn't have if you had the time to think it over. Whereas in Facebook, I feel like wall posts and sending messages and starting threads with other friends, I actually think that does give you a good way of organizing your thoughts before you put it on or post it on a wall. So I don't think it necessarily diminishes the amount of time that you take in thinking about what you're saying to the people around you.
Let me get a call from David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling in regard to some statistics that I've seen regarding depression amongst college students. I'm very close to the Williams College campus, mm-hmm. and they have a campaign going on called Half of Us, and it's based upon this following statement from the National College Health Assessment. It says, in its 2006 National College Health Assessment, the American College Health Association found that almost half of surveyed college students had reported being so depressed that they could not function and that more than half had thought about suicide at some point in their lives.
Wow.
So my point is that if all of this texting and connecting is so good, why are we still dealing? And it's not necessarily that there's a direct connection here, but I kind of sense that there's something that's not, how do I want to put it, all of this mm-hmm. communicating is not what it's cracked up to be. So I'll leave it there. If you want me to take my answer off the air, I can do that, or I'll hang on.
Well, hang on. We're coming up to a break, but let us go to it. Mimi Ito, how about it? Maybe it takes a village to raise, to be, to flourish. But our caller David says, you know, if this is so great, how come half of college kids, at least in this survey he cites, report that they're so depressed they can barely function?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's very hard to say, you know, the media is causing one thing or another. Mm-hmm. I think we have to look at some of the broader pressures that young people are experiencing in terms of the escalation of competitive pressures, you know, the broader context of, you know, kids' hopes for the future and things like that, which, you know, I would think have, you know, a much more systematic set of effects on things like that. You know, but then I think there are definitely ways in which we can look at the new media and say, you know, how could we do better about how we're engaging with this? How can adults help bridge the generation gap in terms of the perception or guiding these kinds of uses of new media? So I don't think it's enough to just sit back and say these media don't have, you know, a negative or they automatically have a positive effect. It's really about saying how can we move forward on some of this stuff.
And of course, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. But I mean, you look out there, I don't know, the economy, the climate, the national debt, a lot of what these kids are inheriting, maybe 75% would be depressed if it weren't for the internet. Who knows? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American teens and the internet and the new American youth culture unfolding on the web. Mimi Ito is with us. She helped lead a huge new study of teen use of the internet, all the socializing and sometimes going deep on particular topics and learning geekdom that emerges there, they call it. She's with us from Culver City, California. Abella Aniti Anahuerta And Sarah Polin are with us as well. Teens are just out of their teens in Anna's case, all big users of the Internet, here to tell us what they do, what they know. Let's get a call from Lander, Wyoming, and Christina. Hi, Christina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to comment on a few things. When I had done a study in my sociology class of subcultures in adolescent youth, and I focused my study on actually some of the Facebook people, because Facebook had just come about when I was in college for the last 3 years. And some of the things that I had also found with the whole creation of Facebook was that other people that were doing studies for psychology or biology, they would use the networking that they could with, you know, the 500 friends that they made and ask them to participate in my survey or participate in the study that I'm doing. So in that way, Facebook was definitely a great help in getting their research together. Some of the downsides was that I'm starting to see now that I've moved into the office setting, is that the 15-minute breaks that you can take in between the work that you're doing, you can connect yourself at an instant to all the friends that you've made throughout your life, because you can connect to the high school friends, to middle school friends, college friends, and friends that you've made long distance with your travels. And it sort of interrupts your daily program with your work, because you can be so connected to everyone anywhere. So that was one of the downsides that I think...
Christina, you see that as a downside? In what sense? That you're maybe less alive to the world that's actually around you, that you're actually in the midst of, because a chunk of your mind is still living with old buddies spread out all over the, you know, the world?
Yes and no. It's good. I feel that it's good to have those connections to those people, to see what they are doing with their lives. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how many of my friends from, you know, back home are already married and starting a family, and it just amazes me. But on the downside, the people that you're making friends with that you don't see or that you've met through other friends, it does take away that realness and the actual interaction that we used to have. Like that one caller commented that, you know, you don't just go down the street anymore to go say hi to this person, because you can either, you know, instant message them with your BlueBerry, or you can instant message them over the computer or through Facebook. And so I think, like anything with technology that's come up these days, there's a good and there's a bad. It's just all in how you use it, I suppose. And
living in a lot of worlds at once there. Christina, in Lander, Wyoming, thanks for that call. Sarah Polin, what about it? You've heard several callers now raise some questions, say, well, maybe all these interactions are superficial, or maybe they take you out of sort of the real world you're sitting in, or maybe they encourage a kind of instant reaction that makes kids less reflective or thoughtful. You're 14. We've already heard it's sewn into your life. Do you see it as an advantage, or do you ever wonder, Sarah, if, oh, what would I be doing if I weren't so wired in?
I don't really think that that's necessarily true for kids who are used to having Facebook ever since, I don't know, they first discovered it when they were, I don't know, 10 or 11, because they've become used to seeing their friends at school and connecting on Facebook. And granted, there is a large amount of interaction that goes on the Internet, but there's still that oh, I saw what you did on the Internet last night conversation that carries over into the real world. Now, for people you don't know very well or that you can't interact with personally, I do think that there's a little loss there.
Let's go to Samantha in Short Hill, New Jersey. Samantha, you're on.
Hello, sir.
Hi, you're on, Samantha.
Oh, hi. I'm calling because I actually did my senior research project on looking at the interactions that occur in face-to-face conversation versus instant message conversation. By analyzing the words, we determined that we looked at discourse markers, words like like, and it actually showed that in face-to-face conversation, the discourse markers indicate much more connection between humans as opposed to in instant messaging.
Now, a discourse marker would just be the kind of language used, the weight or substance of the language used?
We looked at the discourse markers and previous studies that had been conducted that showed, you know, discourse markers such as like, in my case, right, you know, they indicate what sort of what part of the brain is being used, what the purposes are, whether or not they're used to kind kind of indicate interest in the conversation or to indicate that you're going to continue on or just used as an affirmation or acknowledgement of thought.
Samantha, does that mean you're buying the perspective that there's a dumbing down here or a superficiality, or is that just the kind of the style of I am and just one angle on a big universe of paths here?
I was shocked to find that the discourse markers used in I am are much, the ones used in instant messaging were much less likely to indicate affirmation on the part of the listener, on the part of the receiver of the conversation. They're more often used by the speaker and themselves, and also in instant messaging, since it's so possible to conduct two simultaneous conversations on different topics, it provides less human connection, you know, apart from just the whole face-to-face part.
Right. Fascinating. Mimi Ito in Culver City, how about it? Maybe this generation is just juggling, you know, spinning 1,000 plates at once, but really engaged with few of them.
I think that there's no question that communication online and through text is different from face-to-face communication. You know, there's a whole host of new sort of styles of writing. I mean, IM is just one among a whole range of different online communication forms. I mean, kids are using video to communicate with one another. Kids are using wall posts, which are also really different from IM because they're not immediate. And, you know, one of our researchers, Christo Sims, describes it as composed casualness because they actually take, you know, a lot of time to write these things, but it's really within this informal conversational mode. So I think it's important to say, look, there's new kinds of social and online literacies that are happening that are really different from face-to-face. I think the other thing that it's important to recognize, especially for kids who are, you know, under 18, who are in high school or middle school, that, you know, kids don't have the same kind of freedom to just go out and see their friends whenever they want. And in fact, you know, that's getting more difficult for kids to have that sort of unstructured time and the freedom to go out in public places to meet with their friends. You know, that kind of mall culture, the ability to go in and out of people's homes is really eroding for a new generation. And so it's important to realize that kids, if given the choice, they would often rather see their friends in real life, but they don't always have that option.
Abella, what do you think about this idea of wall posts? This, of course, is Facebook. You can go and put up something for, you know, the addressee to read, and others for that matter. But the composed casualness, that caught my ear because there is this sense of a composed personality online. You can take the time and to even more than in a direct interaction, to craft the face you show the world. Is that a good thing? Is that a weird thing? Does it lead to fake personality or, I don't know, considered personality?
It definitely opens up a way for someone to express themselves in a way that they wouldn't in real life, in the way that you and I are communicating right now.
More genuine or less?
Less. Well, it depends. It depends on the person. I think it's more often less genuine because, you know, not only, especially with wall posts, you're not just posting for that singular person, but their friends and people who are posting on their wall get to see it. So you want to make sure that your message is abbreviated or doesn't have everything that you may really want to say, just so that you can convey your message to your friend without giving away or saying too much, so that other people who look at the post may not think something else that you didn't really want them to.
But also that you come across as a certain kind of cat. I mean, you're constructing your sort of virtual world image, personality there, right? I mean, we're always doing that, but
your own personal persona, the way that you want to craft it that you may not be able to convey in real life.
Ana Huerta, thinking about that, do you see, in your case, for example, do you see, maybe this is too much to ask, maybe this is too much candor, but is there a difference between you, Anna, sitting there, flesh and blood, you know, in person? Is there any little margin of difference between that and what you present online? Are you kind of a character online that you burnish and create and compose for the world?
I have times where I type so fast where I feel like my fingers are actually doing the talking and I press enter so fast or messages just go. So sometimes it is on instant, like as if I were talking. I can type over 100 words per minute, so I get my ideas out there to people pretty quickly. But then there are times where I do take time to think about what I'm actually going to tell this person, and, oh, that might sound too mean, so I erase it, go back, or that sounds too I don't know, too girly or, mm-hmm. you know, so sometimes I do go back and rewrite it. And that often I know is kind of fake when I start talking to people like that.
Let's go to Martha in Boston. Hi, Martha, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I am a mom of three daughters.
Uh-huh.
I'm 47 years old. I've just recently discovered Facebook, along with a lot of friends of mine. So we've been on Facebook, and when my daughter discovered that I was on Facebook, she at first was upset because she thought I was going to see her Facebook page, which I purposely did not ask to be friended into her
okay.
Facebook page. But when she sees I'm on Facebook and, like, she has her friends in the house, she'll come over and she'll say, look, my mom's on Facebook. Like, it's cool. Like, it's sort of this twisted thing where it's not okay, but yet I'm okay because I'm doing it. I'm not seeing her Facebook. You know, it's interesting. Like, we're using it in a really great way. Just actually, I'm a real estate agent, so I can use it even in my business
right.
dealing sometimes. But it's a way for me to kind of connect with my daughter without her thinking I'm invading her privacy, but we have something in common.
So you and your buddies, fellow moms maybe, getting on Facebook to kind of understand this world, to get a toe in it, maybe more than that, but you haven't asked to be a Facebook friend of your daughter so that yeah. you're not actually in their personal space.
Right.
If you asked, would they let you?
No.
So, Martha, thank you for that. Sarah Polin, what about it? Are your parents, you know, in the middle of all this, in the thick of it? Are they on Facebook? Would you friend them? Would you let them on your page?
My parents are into, you know, Facebook and much the internet scene, but I think there is that sort of, oh, this is my daughter's thing, my daughter's friends, and she, I think, tries to stay out of it. And I mean, she's friend requested me, but I've kind of been, you know, mom, you can't, you know, do this. So
please, what do you think? I mean, it sounds like they're fairly hip. Anna, what do you think your parents' generation might or might not understand about what's going on in the internet world of you and your friends? You know, what would freak them out or be, I don't know, mystifying to them?
Well, my dad's 61 and my mom's 57, so they're pretty much the older generation right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad's a little bit more freaked out about it. It took him a while to kind of latch onto his internet thing and social networking with me, but he'll never be on it.
But what freaks him out, or what would freak him out? What exactly? It's not just that you're on it. It must be what's there.
Meeting people that I don't know, potential stalkers. I think things that a father would be scared about, me walking alone in the real world and talking to random strangers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to convey that to him because there's this big generation gap. But my mom's side, she's a little bit more the hip mom, and she's actually my friend on MySpace and Facebook. And I do keep composure on my sites just because I just the same in the real world, I don't want to present, you know, a bad image of myself. And so my mom sees that online and she's totally fine with it.
But you're a little bit reined in maybe with mom in there as well. Let's go to Don in Augusta, Georgia. Don, you're on the air.
Well, thanks. I hope my cell phone lasts here. You know, I'm interested as a professor. I had a youth focus series many years ago that I did. The tight-knit fabric of young people. How can an adult not go in to teach and tell and talk, but as an inquiry to find out what their responses is to this whole world that they're involved in a listening ear? How can an adult invade without intruding, you know, and get connected to a lot of that that the young people are doing?
That's a great question, Don, and I bet it's on many people's minds. Abella, how about it? Don, he's sitting in Augusta, Georgia. He's sensing this whole world and the fabric of it. He'd like to invade without intruding. I mean, what's a good way for you know, non-teen, you know, something plus adults to kind of understand? Should they just dive in the pool here and get going on Facebook?
Well, I think nowadays you find yourself seeing a lot of adults communicating on Facebook themselves. Mm-hmm. So in Don's case, I think that, yeah, he should just try it. I don't know if he has any kids or if he's a little hesitant because he doesn't want to invade anyone's private space. But I think that nowadays a lot of adults are just trying it out for themselves so they can learn to understand what's going on, what this new era of social networking is really all about.
Don, you'll probably find more people there your age than you might guess at this point. Mimi, and then, of course, and it's getting short shrift here, but there's also, it's not just the social side. I mean, your study looks also at kids who really get captivated with a particular subject. I think parents would be thrilled if that's something, you know, if it's rocket science, if it's, you know, if it's something on the tawdry side, and there's plenty of that on the web, it could be worrying.
I think that's right. You know, I think that adults have a role to play in a lot of different areas. You know, I think your caller, Martha, was a really good example of an enlightened parent who was saying, look, you know, I'm going to take some time to, you know, learn and engage and figure out what's happening. I think the same thing can happen on the interest-driven side. But what's interesting is that while kids don't usually like parents looking over their shoulder and their friendship networks, when it comes to sort of special interests and activities that, you know, we find that adults have a really productive role to play within the same social networks that kids are engaged in. So a lot of these interest groups are mixed age, and adults participate as peers who really share the same interests and passions. And that's where you see, you know, a role for educators and parents to play. You know, just like parents have provisioned, you know, science kits or music lessons for kids, the internet is a huge resource for parents to be able to support and guide kids' interests.
It's got ups, it's got downs, but it is definitely all around us now and woven in tight to this new generation. Mimi Ito, Mizuko Ito at the University of California, Irvine, thank you for all your work on this study, and thank you for sharing some of your results with us today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to thank our young internet users here. Sarah Poland, freshman at Redondo Union High School in Redondo Beach, 14 years old. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you too, Tom. It was great to be here.
Ana Huerta, junior at the University of Southern California. Great to have you with us, Ana.
Thank you, Tom.
And Abella Aniti, our on-point intern. Great to have you back with us even just for a day, Abella. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.